Hello, this is Rohan. I thought I'd do a podcast for a change. I don't think I've actually done one on this website before. And here we are. We're in a place called the Old Spiegel Garden, which is a venue here at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And I've been doing some work with the Edinburgh Festivals around their sort of digital strategy and so on. And so I've been thinking a lot about the web and its connectivity and so on. And with me today, as special guest, is Tom from beingordinary.org, who's come to stay for the weekend, which is lots of fun. And interesting thing about Tom is that I've met him before, but I haven't really, in that we were on a retreat. We found out recently that we were on the same two-week retreat together in 2005 by a really lovely teacher called Arjun Vimalo at Amaravati Monastery, just north of London. But it was only through, I don't know what it first was, maybe through Twitter or Buddhist Geeks or my blog, that he found out about me. And since then, we've been sort of spending a lot of time chatting on Skype chat rather than actually talking in person. At the same time, we've also been, we set up a Facebook group together. Well, Tom set it up and I sort of helped co-admin it. So we've been doing lots of stuff, but all online. And this is the first time, like just this weekend, we've met in person, despite we've sort of known each other online for a few months now. And so what I was interested to talk to Tom about was about how his experience of the relation between the spiritual practice and the web and how that supported it. Supported his sort of ongoing investigation. So it'd be great, Tom, if you just say a little bit about beingordinary.org, how it works, and also sort of what your experience of that has been and what you've learned through that so far.
Well, of course, starting Being Ordinary wasn't a big plan. It was just like we never knew what was going to happen. It was just, well, why not? Something might come of it, something might not. So it was just a shot in the dark, really. And I must say, I've been really amazed and inspired by the response and what's come from it.
It's essentially a podcast site, isn't it?
Yeah, it did actually start as a blogging site, and we called it something different, Sheer Uncanniness. But me and my friend Mike really felt that we wanted to put ourselves a bit more on the line. It's easier to hide behind words, and some of the things that we were saying.
You're saying I'm hiding behind words?
No, I think when you're talking about when you're saying like really centered, like big things about spiritual matters, it gives you a bit more credibility when you're hearing someone's voice. It's a bit harder to hide or to fabricate. So you're a lot more nervous, I guess. Nerves is quite a good thing, I think.
Yeah.
So it was quite hard at first.
Yeah, because I think we were like, me and you were talking about this morning about how, and last night, about the best, we were talking about the best Dhamma talks we'd been to or spiritual talks we'd listened to, and what they tend to share is a real sense of the speaker is on their edge of their understanding, and there's that sort of sense of, I guess they call it transmission in Zen, of like real sort of presence in the room where the listener and the speaker are both in this sort of shared space together. And it's easy, like you say, it's easier when you're writing to edit away that liveness. And it's interesting that we're here in the Edinburgh Festival, which is all about that interaction between audience and liveness. And like the best thing about my experience of live music and theatre, which is sort of my preference, is the best work is when I'm really in that space of vibrancy. So yeah, that's interesting, that difference between podcasting and blogging. So what did you feel that, we've got loads of stuff that people find interesting, or were you unsure whether there'd be an audience for your stuff?
We just felt really vain at first. We just thought vain and arrogant, and that no one would be interested at all. And I guess that we sort of saved our backs, covered our backs by calling it Being Ordinary, in the sense that we had nothing to lose. We were not trying to prove anything. But secretly, we really do want to prove something. Secretly.
Well, the secret's out.
Secretly, we really want to be extraordinary. We want people to love us.
That's really, I think that's, we were, again, we were talking about this before, about the motivation. When we start, when anyone starts sharing, be it teaching, blogging, tweeting, podcasting, whatever, the sort of twin motivation of vanity, as you said, and just the sheer generosity of the act of, and I think that's where, so that, and to the observer, you can't tell the difference between someone being vain and someone being, but you know, as the speaker yourself, where that place is coming from. And what's, so what's the response been like to being ordinary, and what's that been like to receive?
It's been, on the whole, it's been pretty good. I mean, some people have really felt really grateful for what we've been saying, because I think a lot of what we've been trying to do is sort of counter a sort of tendency of exoticism and romanticism in the spiritual scene, that somehow spiritual practice has to be austere, that you have to be a certain type of character, that you have to have certain conditions in order to experience the more profound dimensions to life. And I think we've tried to bring it down to earth a little bit, into the real world, as it were, the world, the work, nine to five work a day life, and living with all the things that that you do.
And has doing the podcast helped your own understanding as a sort of developmental process for yourself, rather than just sort of sharing stuff that you knew already? Or
yeah, because I think you really have to put yourself on the line. Because the whole spontaneity of having to speak, of having to formulate your words as they happen, as they come out of your mouth, it's much harder to fall back on cliches and previously built structures of thought. You really find...
Well, some teachers make a living out of that, of course.
Well, yeah, I think that's it, right. Yeah, exactly. Because it's like you rehearse certain ideas and way of presenting those ideas. And you like it when you're put into a situation where you're in control of that situation. And then you feel like you're getting... you're communicating what you want people to hear. But I think what I found useful about doing the podcasts is that there's only so far you can edit it, there's only so much you can rehearse it, there's only so much you can plan it, and that you do actually find yourself saying things that you didn't know you could say, and saying them in ways that you didn't know you could say. So it's an exciting act of creation, of creativity. So that's been really useful in terms.
And I personally have sort of found that as my... I remember, so we met, and we're on the same Ajahn Vimla retreat, and I remember once driving Ajahn Vimla somewhere to a day-long retreat and talking to him. I was complaining to him. I was saying, I'm fairly sort of as a sort of late 20s practitioner who sort of getting more and more serious and more sort of into the deep end of Buddhist practice, I was sort of complaining, oh, I don't like, there aren't that many people around like me, and I feel I need that support. And he said, I was expecting him to go, oh no, it's fine, like, he just said, get over it. Which was a brilliant thing to hear. He was like, get over, like, yeah, like, I, when I was, he said, like, yeah, when I first met Ajahn Sumedho, I worked really hard. I practiced as a layman for years and years, and like, I stuck out like a sore thumb. But I trusted that. I trusted him. I trusted the practice. Trusted the teachings. And it's never that the results of that he's enjoyed. And so that was a good message. But also, as well as the sort of, I've sort of got over it in the sense of I've stopped looking. I've sort of stopped sort of doing the whole poor me, there isn't, but what I have found is that through online channels I've got access to conversations and networks and people who are, it's a sort of an obvious statement, just by opening up to a wider audience, just that digital comms allows you to do, you do have access to people who are more interested in stuff like you, and if you know how to find them. So using the Buddhist Geeks community, people who respond to my blog, other bloggers, work like yours, it's really supported me in my own practice, and that's I found that that's been the most important support community I have, because in a way it's sort of it's almost like on demand as well, because you don't I use local groups when I can and if I think they're appropriate, but there's not always the shared language or shared intention. That have you found anything similar like that, or the sort of what's been experience of reaching out? I hate this sort of, it's not, I don't call it like digital sangha, I don't, it's more just like just having a more having a wider conversation with people who are sort of, it's a different, I don't think this, the word sangha feels appropriate, it just sort of, it's just, yeah, I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, no, I very much found that. I think you could perhaps split people, anybody, into two halves. Well, anybody who's involved in a spiritual practice, you have a spiritual dimension to your life, so you might have a local group, you might have a teacher, you might read books. So you go through a process of developing, evolving your spiritual side. But I think a lot of people, most people also have the work side, say, of their life, work and family side of their life, which also requires development. And that is also, it's almost as if that's another circle of friends, another environment. And that's certainly been the case for me. Like, I have friends who aren't at all into a meditative spiritual practice, but really important to me, but don't share. There's not that overlap of the two circles. But, yes, people like yourself, Alan Chapman from Open Enlightenment, Vincent Hawke from Buddhist Geeks, to me seem like it's that crossover between people who are the same age, they're into...
People can go for a drink with and talk about the Dhamma.
That's exactly it, which is such a rare, nourishing, sanity-giving thing that is just wonderful. So I feel so grateful for that gift. Yeah, as much as anything, forgive making me feel a little bit normal.
Yeah. I think that's really important. I think, especially within, and I think we're sort of at an age. You're 29,
28. 29 on Monday.
29 on Monday. Oh, he's just giving away his birthday in 2 days' time. Very good. And I'm 30, just recently, and I think that's an interesting age, sort of. This, I have a theory about that, I'm not sure whether it's appropriate, but how it's sort of, to really understand, or unless you're incredibly gifted, it takes a maturity and a have sort of kicking it about that you really get to understand what this whole, certainly within my limited sort of area of Buddhism, that it's taken me, like if I look back 2 years ago and my what I thought and what I understood about the practice, it seems sort of just quite kiddie, kindergarten. But like, and I know that the same will be again in 2 years' time, and that's really great. That's really exciting, because I feel quite, that means that there's always an ongoing maturing. But it's sort of, the people who are doing like really exciting things all seem sort of clustered around a similar age. Maybe that's just because I'm that age and I'm looking at them. But I think there's this particular generation is quite interesting, who's sort of late 20s, mid-late 20s, they've done maybe sort of 5 to 10 years practice, got a really good foundation in it, understand the scene, that the more established scene, the sort of the generation above, well, appreciate them, but also sees the limitations, and they're starting to innovate in that space, and that's really exciting. I think I feel part of a movement, and I don't know whether you feel the same.
Yeah, I do too. And in a way, it's what I've always wanted to be part of. It's the sort of romantic ideal of being at the forefront, a pioneer in a great mysterious adventure, and with fellow comrades facing an unknown horizon and digging deep to find totally new creative solutions that fit perfectly to the problems that we're facing. and it feels like quite an honour, quite a privilege to have found myself in this position. You know, I've got a good head on me, a good education, but I've also coming into contact with these new East, what are essentially Eastern ideas, and that's all quite new. And trying to, I mean, I think that the very essence of what Eastern spirituality has to teach us, I don't think truly has any shape, colour, form, size, smell. That we are really given the opportunity to really invent it as we see appropriate. That it could take any form. That there's no reason why you can't tweet your enlightenment, as Alan Chapman famously did. There's no reason why these new pervasive forms of communication and media that we're finding ourselves using can't be vehicles for communicating the most profound and sensitive ideas in totally original ways that might be more useful than some of the old ways of doing it.
Well, I think that's brilliantly put. I don't think I can top that. So I want to wrap up our first... This is my first audio boo for 21 Awake. So let me know if you thought it was any good, whether I should do any more. And we'll go and see some stand-up, I think, soon. So see ya.